From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, crime writer Dennis Lehane. His best-selling novel, Mystic River, is now out in paperback and back on the bestseller list. Clint Eastwood is adapting it into a film. This week, the LA Lakers won their third consecutive NBA championship, and Coach Phil Jackson became the league's all-time winner in postseason coaching victories. We'll hear an excerpt of the interview Jackson recorded 1 year ago. Also, we hear from artist Larry Rivers. There's a major retrospective of his work at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the World War II movie Wind Talkers, directed by John Woo, starring Nicolas Cage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has overwhelmingly approved a new policy that would remove priests from the active ministry if they sexually abuse children. The policy means that priests would no longer be able to hold Mass in public or wear the Roman collar and other clerical garb. Victims groups say the policy doesn't go far enough. Barbara Blaine, president of the Survivors Network of those abused by priests, wants offenders to be stripped of their priesthood.
Why they feel this need to include child molesters within the ranks, it just defies understanding. It's not rational.
The bishops say they don't have the authority to defrock priests. That's a church judicial process that must be approved by the Vatican. The federal judge in the Arthur Andersen trial ruled today on a critical question from the jury, which could speed a verdict in the six-week-long trial. NPR's Cheryl Corley is in Houston.
Judge Melinda Harmon said the question from the jurors was in the forefront of her mind from the moment they asked it. Did they all have to agree that one specific person was guilty of obstructing justice in order to find the accounting firm guilty? Or could jurors have varying opinions? The jury has been deliberating for 9 days in an effort to decide whether Andersen, through its employees, corruptly persuaded others to destroy audit documents to keep them away from federal investigators. Andersen had argued the jurors must all agree that one specific person was guilty to find Andersen guilty, but the judge said no. The decision could break the deadlock the jury announced it was in earlier this week. Prosecutors said they were gratified. Andersen's lead defense attorney, Rusty Hardin, asked for a mistrial, saying the ruling could be coercive to those who still believed Andersen was innocent. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Houston.
Diplomatic sources in Washington are warning of possible conflict along Israel's border with Lebanon. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Speaking on condition of anonymity, a senior diplomat says the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah has moved heavier weapons into southern Lebanon in recent weeks. The buildup is believed to include longer-range surface-to-air rockets. The source says Iranian Revolutionary Guards have been training in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. Israeli officials also have been warning about such a development for months. The fear is that Hezbollah could stage another attack into Israel within days. If so, diplomats warn there could be a major Israeli retaliation. These heightened tensions come as the Bush administration is preparing a new initiative to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Fighting along the Lebanese border would likely put that on hold. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 28 points to close at 9,574 in heavy trading of more than 1.5 billion shares. For the week, the Dow was down 115 points. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 7 points. It closed at 1,504. The NASDAQ was down 30 points for the week. This is NPR News. Police in Texas are trying to confirm the identity of a man who fits the description of Brett Michael Edmonds, who's wanted for questioning in the kidnapping of a 14-year-old Salt Lake City girl. A spokeswoman for the sheriff's office in Lamb County, Texas, says the man was arrested today for shoplifting in a department store. Salt Lake City police have said Edmonds is not a suspect in the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart, but may have information they can use. For the first time since 1994, the U.S. men's soccer team has made it to the second round of the World Cup tournament. The Americans advanced despite losing today to Poland 3-1. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
If the World Cup were a strict meritocracy, the tournament would be over for the United States. After a rousing victory over Portugal and a tie against host South Korea, the Americans played their worst game of the first round today against Poland. Needing only a tie to move on to the second round, the U.S. fell behind 2-0 in the first 5 minutes and could never recover. But because teams qualify for the second round based on points, the U.S. advanced despite the poor performance. South Korea rescued the Americans by upsetting Portugal, which meant the points America got for the earlier win and tie were enough for the U.S. to move on. The U.S. plays Mexico Monday, which is certain to generate lots of interest in this country, particularly in places with large numbers of Hispanic fans. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
The State Department is considering whether to further reduce the number of U.S. diplomats in Pakistan following a suicide bombing that killed at least 11 people and injured 45 outside the U.S. consulate in Karachi. No Americans were killed, but a Marine guard and 5 Pakistani workers were slightly injured. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from DMZ, Columbia Records, and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Information online at ralphstanley.net.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dennis Lehane's novel Mystic River has just come out in paperback and is back on the bestseller list. Clint Eastwood is adapting the novel into a film. Last year, when the novel was first published, New York Times book critic Janet Maslin wrote, "There is no better reason than Mystic River to stay home with a good book." Dennis Lehane is best known for his series of Private Eye novels featuring the team of Patrick Kenzie and Angie Gennaro. But Mystic River isn't part of the series and isn't a Private Eye novel. It begins in 1975, when 3 boys are fighting in the street, and a couple of cops drive by to break it up. 2 of the boys flee. The 3rd is picked up by the cops, who turn out to really be child molesters posing as cops. The boy is released after several days and returns home traumatized. The novel picks up 25 years later and follows the lives of the 3 childhood friends. One is an ex-con who owns a corner store. His daughter has been murdered. The other has become a homicide detective and is investigating the murder. The 3rd, the one who was abducted, is a suspect. Last year, when the novel was published in hardcover, I asked Lehane if the abduction in the novel relates to anything that happened to him as a child.
No, I'm not a big believer in autobiographical fiction, if you will. I believe in the place and the flavor of the world you grew up in. But I don't believe in the particulars. I don't believe in, remember when, Johnny Sullivan did this and he had this certain way of smiling. Let's take that and put it in a book. I don't do that. But I do try and capture sort of, again, the texture and the flavor of the world I grew up in. This incident happened actually to myself and a friend of mine who were, not quite arrested, but we were taken off the street and we were getting in a fight and we were kids. And in the sort of heat of the moment, neither of us thought to ask for a badge. It turned out the gentlemen were cops, but that was something that always stuck in my head, I think, because my mother looked so terrified.
She suspected that maybe they weren't cops?
No, she just didn't. She thought the whole incident seemed weird mm-hmm. at the time. It turned out they were police officers, everything, but I'll never forget the fear when, she said, you saw their badge, right?
No, it's this abduction that sets everything in motion in your new novel.
Yep.
There's sexual abuse in an earlier book, Gone Baby Gone, where a child's abducted. You worked briefly, I think, counseling children who
yes.
have been abused. What kind of work did you do?
I was a therapeutic counselor in a treatment facility. We would take kids from, review files in juvenile hall, and we would pick kids who we thought were sort of in the gray area between when a victim turns into a victimizer, and we would try and get them before they turned into victimizers and help them. And that was what we did. And that was the place I worked.
What are some of the things you learned during that experience that you used in your writing?
Well, I think I remember a woman I was dating at the time said, that she had never seen me angry until I took this job. that I was a pretty, even keel type of guy. So I discovered a capacity for anger at the waste that I'd see. I also discovered a very sort of dirty secret of social work, which was, you know, 9 out of 10 times, it's the parent. You can trace it back to the parent. A bad seed is a very rare thing. And it's not society, and it's not Marilyn Manson, and it's not, you know, it's kids who were abused, or kids who were neglected, or kids who were badly parented, who turn out to be, you know, the kind of kids who shoot up schools, or the kind of kids who become bullies, or become murderers, become anything. And then it just depends upon the level of abuse. That can dictate a lot of things, because if the humanity is beaten out of you, or sexually exploited out of you, then it's silly to expect that humanity will be recovered.
My guest is writer Dennis Lehane. Your new novel, Mystic River, is different from your other novels in that although there are crimes at its center, it's not about private detectives, and it's not part of your private detective series. Why was it time for you now to get out of that series and write a book that's independent of that?
Oh, I think it just, a lot of times it's just dictated by, you know, I wish we had a word for it, the inspiration, whatever mm-hmm. you want to say. I was not inspired to write a book in the series. There was nothing there. The well was dry. And this book had been sort of gently rapping on the window for about 5 or 6 years. And then it began to really bang on the door about 2 years ago.
What was the message as it was banging?
You know, make a hole, make it wide, let us in. I always start with characters. I very rarely have a plot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just the characters. And there was this one line, Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love. And that line just kept spinning around in my head for years. I mean, 5 years probably. And then gradually I got the second line, which was it occurred to him as he was shaving that he was evil. And those two lines began to sort of become the the building blocks of the book.
And where do they actually turn up in the book?
Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy is the very first line of the present day, first chapter in present day. That's the first line of chapter 3, which is the first chapter in the 2000 section. And then it occurred to him while he was shaving that he was evil shows up in the last chapter.
So let me ask you to read that line that first came to you before the novel was written. And now it's that first line in the first chapter set in the present.
Sure. Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love, with an orchestra booming through his blood and flooding his ears. He loved her waking up, going to bed, loved her all day and every second in between. Brendan Harris would love Katie Marcus fat and ugly. He'd love her with bad skin and no breasts and thick fuzz on her upper lip. He'd love her toothless. He'd love her bald. Katie, the trill of her name sliding through his brain was enough to make Brendan feel like his limbs were filled with nitrous oxide, like he could walk on water and bench press an 18-wheeler, toss it across the street when he was finished with it. Brendan Harris loved everyone now because he loved Katie and Katie loved him. Brendan loved traffic and smog and the sound of jackhammers. He loved his worthless old man who hadn't sent him a single birthday or Christmas card since he'd walked out on Brendan and his mother when Brendan was 6. He loved Monday mornings and standing in line at the RMV. He even loved his job, though he wouldn't be going in ever again.
So you used that sentence, that first sentence that came to your mind, to very good effect in this passage that you just read. Have you ever had a first sentence that came to your mind that you ended up not using by the time you actually got to writing the book?
Oh, yeah. I think that so often you start with something and all it is a way to get you into a book. Like my next novel, which I've begun, I sort of already know that the first 10 pages I've written will never make the book, you know. But I had to put it in to sort of figure things out for myself. And the trick is you fall in love with some of the sentences and you just got to remember that Orwell line, you know, murder your darlings.
Right.
So.
What do you like about writing familiar characters when you are writing your Private Eye series?
Oh, it's wonderful because I think the same reason readers read these books is because gradually there becomes this almost tender familiarity with these people. And they're like old friends. And it's like saying, come on by, have a drink, you know? You say, come on into the book. Oh, we haven't seen him in a while. We haven't seen him in 400 pages since, you know, book number 4.
What are the limitations?
the reason I read and the reason I write is to discover things about characters. Plot is just a vehicle to do that. That's all plot is. It's just the actions by which a character is explicated. And I think gradually, the more you write about a character, the less you don't know about them. And the more you read about a character, the less you don't know about them. And that's why I think that it's very rare you hear somebody speak about a series and say, yeah, but the 15th book is the best. Nobody ever says that. They always say the fifth book is the best or the third book is the best. And I think that's because the characters have become overly familiar. And there is no sense of a journey. There are no epiphanies left to have about this person. So I think that's the point when you got to pull the plug.
Right.
I don't know if I've reached that point yet. I don't think I have, but I think I'm near it.
My guest is writer Dennis Lehane. His latest novel is Mystic River. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis Lehane. His latest novel, Mystic River, is on the bestseller list. Did you have any relatives who were cops? Or,
no.
Or friends' fathers who were cops? Not to just dwell on cliche, but you grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and you know a lot of, particularly when you were growing up, probably a lot of Irish fathers were cops.
Oddly, no. not with my friends. I had one of my closest friends' uncle was a rather prominent cop, mm-hmm. but I had very little contact with him. My wife's family are all cops, but I didn't grow up around cops. I grew up around laborers, you know. Mm-hmm. My father worked for Sears and Roebuck. Most of my friends' fathers worked, you know, they were truck drivers, occasionally a postman. But no, we didn't grow up with that law enforcement vibe around us.
Did your opinion of or relationship with cops change from childhood to adulthood?
No, I think one of the greatest things about growing up in the inner city, if you see it correctly, was that we always knew the places never to go and say drink, for example, when you're 17 years old, underage drinking or smoke pot or whatever. The places to never commit crimes were small towns. Because they always had the absolute toughest cops, because they had, our opinion at the time was, they had nothing better to do. Where in the inner city, we had police officers, and they were a lot of times putting their life, pretty much on the line. They were the ones dealing with gangs, they were the ones dealing with shootouts and homicides, etc. And so they tended to be very easy to deal with if you weren't in their face. And I think that was because they had a relative sense. So if they caught a couple of kids, underage kids drinking beer, they took your beer and they walked away. They didn't have anything to prove, I guess. So I think that gave me a respect for the city cop, for the guy who really has to go out and literally put his life on the line. Whereas small town police, to some extent, there's a bit of a Napoleon complex.
Dennis Lehane is my guest. There's a passage describing the neighborhood that the characters in your book grew up in that I'm going to ask you to read.
Sure. They all lived in East Buckingham, just west of downtown, a neighborhood of cramped corner stores, small playgrounds, and butcher shops where meat, still pink with blood, hung in the windows. The bars had Irish names and dodge darts by the curbs. Women wore handkerchiefs tied off at the backs of their skulls and carried mock leather snap purses for their cigarettes. Until a couple of years ago, older boys had been plucked from the streets as if by spaceships and sent to war. They came back hollow and sullen a year or so later, or they didn't come back at all. Days, the mothers searched the papers for coupons. Nights, the fathers went to the bars. You knew everyone. Nobody, except those older boys, ever left.
Is that an accurate description of the neighborhood you grew up in?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. If you look back, my brother and I were always stunned to look back at pictures taken of us in 71, 73, and we look like we just, you know, we stepped off Main Street in Mayberry. I mean, we still had the buzz cuts, still, you know, the clothing was much more what you would think of in, say, 1963, Brooklyn. you know, just the look of everything. It was, you know, and then right down the street, you know, a couple of miles away, essentially, there's you know, student sit-ins at Harvard. And Harvard Square looks like what you expect Harvard Square to look like circa 1971, 72. But none of that reached the neighborhoods.
What do you want to write about that neighborhood now?
In your 20s, if you're a writer, you spend a lot of your 20s discovering your strengths and your limitations. And what I discovered is while I could write about any place and do it adequately, the stuff that struck a chord that really reached people at a very gut level was the stuff I said in you know, inner city northeastern neighborhoods. Gradually you just go, you know, well, Fitzgerald never wrote about poor people really well, and Faulkner never wrote anything set outside of Mississippi that was any good, and so maybe that's my limitation. Maybe I shouldn't be trying on all these hats. Maybe I should go to my strength.
When you were a kid in the early 70s with the buzz cut, looking like you were in Mayberry RFD, what was your attitude about the college students protesting at Harvard? What did you think of them?
Oh, well, we had a very, I think a very neighborhood attitude, which was, you know, this was also when busing was ripping the inner city apart. Mm-hmm. And there was this very, a siege mentality took over. Because the attitude of the establishment, certainly the establishment newspapers, was that it was a racial issue, where the people who were in the neighborhoods felt it was much more of a class warfare issue. It was about people who didn't live in the neighborhoods making decisions that affected the neighborhoods and then stepping back and letting the neighborhood suffer. And I think certainly the sense of the, you know, when you would see the news and we'd see what was going on at Harvard or what was going on at, you know, Berkeley out in California or wherever, there was a sense of they're dilettantes, you know. They're the fortunate sons, where the people who are truly suffering for this aren't protesting because they're dead or they're dying because they couldn't afford to go to college, etc. So I think that was certainly, there was never a sense in my neighborhood that anybody thought Vietnam was a good idea. You know, never. I remember it was very clear. My father was, you know, if my brother got to that age, which he neared just as the war ended, you know, my father was ready to put him on a plane to Canada.
The characters in your new novel, Mystic River, don't go home at night and, you know, read novels.
No.
Were you a reader as a child?
And oh,
was
God.
That was that unusual in your neighborhood or in your family?
Yes, it was, in both. Well, my brothers were readers, my older brothers. They, you know, they read a lot of, you know, S.E. Hinton and, you know, Robert Ludlum and things like that. So, there was reading, and my sister was read a lot of classics. So there was reading in my family, certainly. And I just picked it up at a much more ferocious clip. I mean, I started reading when I was six. My mother took me to the library when I was six. And it's still the most pivotal event in my life. You know, it changed everything. And so did it seem a little odd to the neighborhood? Yeah, definitely. But the great thing is that everybody was pretty cool about it, too. You know, it wasn't like everybody said, you know, oh, four. Well, I didn't wear glasses, but I wasn't ostracized for being a reader.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, that Lehane kid's a little odd, you know, in the same way that you'd say it about the kid who would every winter would stick his tongue to the pole, you know,
right.
It's a little, he's all right, but he's a little odd.
Did you have anyone to talk to about what you were reading?
No, not for the most part. I think that was certainly, I was in a vacuum, when it came to that, at least till I got to high school. But there's nothing, that's a good vacuum to be in, I think, because, by the time I got to college, for example, and I dropped out of a couple of colleges, and with the second one, I was an English lit major, and I didn't particularly enjoy talking about writing, or literature. I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed practicing it if I could, but I didn't like talking about it. And I think that's a good, that's a good attribute for a writer to have, because I've seen a lot of writers, you know, who I went to school with, who got waylaid by becoming critics, essentially, by talking too much about theories behind writing. And that's not conducive to being a good writer. I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald had a great line where he said that a writer should not be the smartest guy in the room. He should just be the most observant. And, you know, so, again, I didn't talk much with people, but I think that was good early on.
No, you've written or are writing, I believe, a screenplay based on one of your Private Eye novels?
Yes.
So do you have in mind the type of actor you'd like to play your Private Eyes, Patrick and Angie? And I'm wondering, do you want them to be ultra attractive or just to have a lot of screen presence?
Oh, no, I'm much more of a character actor guy. I like people who just, that whatever it is they got, nobody else has it, you know? I'm not talking star power, but say a guy like Will Patton, for example. I don't even know if you know who that
is.
Yeah, I do. But now there's a guy, you put him on the screen, and you know nobody else is going to give a performance like him. Nobody. Will Patton is Will Patton, you know? So I tend towards character actors, which would make me a very bad Hollywood producer because I wouldn't get necessarily bankable stars. I think a perfect Patrick would be Ray Liotta. Although he might be a few years older than him, I think he'd be great. But I don't think Hollywood considers him an A-list star, if you know what I mean, the way they would, say, a Ben Affleck.
Right.
Or a Tom Cruise or something like that. I have my theories, but I also know they're rather impractical.
Dennis Lehane's latest novel, Mystic River, is now out in paperback and is back on the bestseller list. Clint Eastwood is adapting it into a movie. Our interview was recorded last year when the novel was published in hardcover. Ben Affleck is reported to be considering starring in a film of one of Lehane's detective novels. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new series that explores the issues shaping our world and changing our lives. Friday nights at 9 Eastern on PBS. Local times may vary. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of American Chica, Two Worlds, One Childhood by Maria Rana, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Phil Jackson. This week he led the LA Lakers to their third consecutive NBA championship. Also, a talk with painter Larry Rivers. A major retrospective of his work is now at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Wind Talkers, directed by John Woo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the L.A. Lakers won their third consecutive NBA championship, and their coach Phil Jackson became the league's all-time winner in postseason coaching victories. In addition to Jackson's three Lakers championships, he led the Chicago Bulls to six championships and won twice as a player with the New York Knicks. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview I recorded with Jackson 1 year ago when he and the Lakers were a couple of games away from winning the playoffs against the Philadelphia 76ers. Can you compare the experience of coaching the Lakers and the Bulls?
No. It's still coaching, but it's so different. It's such a different team. It's such a different relationship that I have with the team. I'm the same person in many ways, different group of guys. The team in Chicago were mostly young married men with young families. It was a kind of a community of young kids growing up together, wives and families that were involved and intertwined. There was really a remarkable resilience about that team because they supported each other just unequivocally. Their roles were ordered almost impeccably from Michael through Scottie Pippen, down through the order of the players. It just all related very well as to how they had to do it. They could support a character like Dennis Rodman for three years, even though he was, you know, a maverick in many ways. And there was an end in sight. They knew that it was, you know, there was an age in this team. They knew that, hey, we're going to last this year. Maybe we'll get one more year. We got that one more year, and then maybe we could do it again, and we had a three-peat championship. But those players all moved into maybe retirement or moved on or quit the game. And this group is a bunch of young players. It's a different generation. There's very few guys that are married. There's not that community. And yet we have a community that's altogether different and still vibrant and very tight.
I'm wondering if the age difference between you and the players, as you get older and the players stay more or less the same age or even younger than the previous team you coached, if there's certain differences that are difficult to reconcile, and what I'm thinking of particularly is the whole respect thing, the meaning of respect to a lot of people in their 20s now, and the meaning of disrespect and what can be interpreted as disrespect is probably really different than, for instance, when you were playing or when you started coaching.
Without a doubt, Terry, I think you hit that point very well, that it's... The last time we were in Philadelphia to play, Kobe and I had a little bit of a tiff on the bench, and I actually felt that he was trying to do too much on the court, and he wanted to argue with me, and so I sat him on the bench. And I was willing to sit him in a certain point in the game that I felt was important. Shaq was out of the game, so we were out without two of our stars for that period of time, but I wanted to let him know that I didn't want him to argue with me at that point. When we got in the locker room, we had another discussion. And he felt like I disrespected him by imposing upon him the fact that he was being selfish, again, cubbyholing him into this this curtain. And I said, fine, we'll watch the tape together again and sort it out tomorrow. So I realized, you know, there was that's one disrespect, that, you know, don't pigeonhole me with what you think that I was doing that, you know, is a preconceived idea that you have of my game. And the game itself is played to a little different beat. Hip-hop and that kind of generational, you know, noise that's going on has a lot of kind of gangster not being respected, you know, being oppressed, you know, riding the line, living at the edge, willing to sacrifice yourself for your own honor. Those kind of things, I think, are big parts of the culture in this group of youth right now. And I have to respect that for whatever it's worth, as much as I wanted my elders to respect my particular beliefs that I had in the late 60s about war and about countries going to war and about youth being drafted and so forth. So, I mean, I have to respect where they're coming from and wonder where it's taking them to.
But some of that goes against some of your values, you know, that living on the edge and the speed and a lot of the kind of bragging of rap and the kind of thug aspects of it, that kind of goes against who you are as a coach and what you want from your players as a coach.
Well, the part that I like about coaching is my ability to influence. I've been able to kind of take them through, you know, like violence. Is gun violence appropriate, you know, and the idea of possessing and owning guns and making them think those thoughts. And I like the fact that Martin Luther King Day, we have a game on that day, and I can always talk about, you know, Martin Luther King and peaceful resistance, and, you know, and the ability for people to make things happen without having to take armed stands, you know, and having to defend oneself through rational, reasonable approaches.
Now, you're on camera a lot during the games.
Yes.
Are you conscious of that, and are you trying to maintain a public face knowing that at any minute there might be a cutaway to you?
Well, I think we've all had our embarrassing moments on film that are coaches or players, that you're, you know, either caught in a position where you're yelling or something's happened to you, or, you know, you might even be wiping your nose or whatever. But every action that's a reaction, the camera comes back to you. And I've gotten used to that over the years, and I try to remain really equal about my emotions at that time, and not to vent or not to do anything. But I learned that lesson not so much from the camera, but from, you know, having a player like Dennis Rodman on the team who fed directly almost off the emotional state of the coach. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the more animated I got, the more animated he felt he had to be, and it would create this chain reaction. And I felt that the calmer and the easier I was on the whole attitude of the game, the better he felt about the game, and the team responded likewise. And so I've tried to maintain that since that time.
Yeah, I like one sports columnist said something like, Phil Jackson uncrossed his leg. wow, what emotion he showed.
Yeah, people always say, you're not doing much coaching over there.
I want to quote one more thing from your book, More Than a Game. You say, in 1998, after 44 years of being continuously involved with basketball, I cashed in my chips and, quote, retired after winning my sixth championship with the Bulls. In the middle of the journey that is my life, I had lost my way. What did you mean by that, by having lost your way before getting back to basketball?
Well, really, the career in basketball became, you know, so dominant in my life that I felt like I'd lost my kids, my family. It was almost impossible to stay in touch with them at some level with the amount of traveling and everything. And it felt like, you know, somehow or other I kind of lost the whole process of this family that I was very, very, very connected to for many years. And, you know, I went through a period of separation with my wife and, you know, been separated since I've gone to L.A. And for a period of time, it was very devastating for me because I felt like I'd lost my family. But I found that I hadn't lost my family at all. We'd just grown to different positions. And, you know, the kids are here with me in Philadelphia, and it's great. I have five kids and lots of kids, and they're love to come to the finals. It's become like a family ritual, and it's amazing that they can be here.
Phil Jackson recorded 1 year ago. This week he led the Lakers to their third consecutive NBA championship, his ninth championship as a coach. Coming up, painter Larry Rivers. This is Fresh Air. The late poet Frank O'Hara once described his friend, the painter Larry Rivers, like this. Larry entered the scene like a demented telephone. Nobody knew whether to put it in the library, the kitchen, or the toilet, but it was electric. Rivers became one of the most prominent figurative painters to emerge during the period of abstract expressionism. As critic Carrie Rickey put it, he wedded representation with abstraction, parodied art history, anticipated by a decade the concerns of both the pop and color field painters, and prophetically engaged in what postmodernists might call appropriation and deconstruction. The first comprehensive international retrospective of Larry Rivers' work is currently on exhibit at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. I spoke with Rivers in 1992 after the publication of his memoir, What Did I Do? He said in his book he doesn't have the faith in self that abstract painters need. I asked him what he means.
I'm not the kind of painter who thinks, well, I did it, therefore it's got to be good or has meaning or things like that. And so if I put down an orange and a blue and put a line through it and then a big square shape and things like that, I felt as if they're something necessary in carrying that off that I didn't have. I didn't sort of believe in it that way. I didn't really know what art was about in a certain way, or I still don't, you know. I'm not trying to be cute, but I don't really know what exactly it is about. And I can only get at those things that interest me. And I think I must also have something in my nature that wants people, more no matter who, from what part of life and things like that, to get something from the work.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
Now, often when you paint a figure, there's a feature that's missing, you know, like there's one eye, but the other eye is kind of blank. It hasn't been painted at all.
Yes.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I think there was a certain spontaneity in my work. In other words, if no matter what I was doing, I wanted it to come off sort of quickly or without too much trouble. And, you know, as yet I hadn't arrived to the point where I wanted things to look labored and that I really did a lot of hard work, which would be a reflection of a certain kind of good character. So the first eye, you don't have to worry about where you're placing. I mean, you just put it down somewhere below a brow or something like that. But when you come to the second eye, you really have to make calculations about how why they're part. There's no way of putting in a second eye unless you're Picasso, to make them realistic without sort of real close judgment and changes and things that would slow you down, would make your hand work, let's say, from the knuckles instead of an arm movement. And I think that I just left it out at first. For those reasons, I didn't think it was necessary, really, what it amounted to. And I think there are other parts of the body missing, too, but people notice it in the face because the face is so clearly an image that we know all the parts of.
Something else you've done throughout most of your career is write on paintings. Sometimes the letters are stenciled, sometimes handwritten.
Yeah.
Sometimes parts of letters are missing or blurred. How did you start using words on paintings?
Well, I think that, don't forget the Cubists had the word journal. I mean, they would have a newspaper in their painting. So in other words, I didn't do anything that was that, new. The only thing is, I think I was bolder about it and didn't hide it in a certain way. And then it also, in certain paintings, it's almost the point of the painting. I did these vocabulary lessons, which obviously are words and features. And I thought that I thought there was something sort of ironic, I suppose, in all that. And please forgive me for trying to be ironic, but that was one of the reasons. Also, my hand is a very artistic one, in the sense that I make gestures with my paint, and they're like loose flowing and things like that. Whereas a letter has sharp edges, and it's very much more definite than the painting. So the combination of this very definite thing, plus this loose, arty kind of work with colors all over the place, seemed to make me happy.
You married when you were pretty young.
Yes.
Your girlfriend got pregnant, and that's how you ended up getting married. She already had a son.
Right.
But you didn't want a family. In fact, you wrote, "My life was not going to be about living. It was going to be about art."
Right.
So you felt pretty trapped by having a family.
I guess so. I given my personality, I probably didn't even feel trapped. I nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've felt a little bit something. Don't forget, I never really gave them up, and eventually I really brought them up. I brought up these boys and lived with the woman's mother. I lived with my wife's mother. I didn't live with the wife. So it's complicated looking it over. I mean, I was not going to be stopped from what I wanted to do, but at the same time, I wasn't going to abandon the boys or, the mother. And we lived together, and they were very helpful in many ways.
Do you think that you couldn't have become an artist without being somewhat selfish?
That's right. I think I modeled myself on my distorted notion of what Picasso was about. I thought that somewhere along the line I had heard that, without reading it somewhere, that Picasso, walked away from every relationship and children and things like that, and all that life was about was art. And I felt that that model was something that it was of interest to me.
Looking back, do you think that you behaved badly toward your family?
Some people might. I don't think I behaved badly. I made up in one way. I was sort of, on my own, selfish, things like that, but at the same time I provided for them. And so it's not very different than what most men are about. They go to offices 8-10 hours a day. and they come back and don't bother me. They're looking at television or a newspaper, they're drinking a beer or whatever it is, and then the child walks in, they give them a two-minute kiss. Maybe once a year they go somewhere for 3 weeks or something. I don't think life is that different, you know, among for myself and other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guess is the...
Selfish, I would never deny that I'm selfish, but I can make a case for everybody being selfish.
Mm-hmm. My guess is the artist Larry Rivers. Now, your mother-in-law, who you lived with for many years, you painted her naked a couple of times.
Yes.
And I'll just describe her physically briefly. She's you know, an older woman, kind of heavy, an almost what we'd describe as peasant-like body.
Okay.
Is it fair?
I never heard that expression about a body. Go ahead. But anyway, you mean the painting that's in the Whitney Museum? It's Birdie Twice?
Birdie Twice, yeah. Why did you want... You know, it seems like a real taboo, don't you think, to paint your mother-in-law naked?
Well, I told my mother-in-law, if you read the book, that part, I said to Birdie, she sort of said, why do you want to paint me? You know, she had the simple notion that an artist wants to paint beautiful things. She looked at herself. She didn't think she was beautiful. So I said, Rembrandt painted older women. I forget her name. Anyway, she's got her 2 feet in a stream, and she has a kind of a gown raised up. And she's not a young woman. Now, you didn't see her breast, but there are others that Rembrandt did, where you do see this older woman. I thought that I had a very special opportunity. I was able to get someone that age, close to me, who actually I could really look at and see what was going on. So it had two levels. I painted it to make a painting and things like that, but I couldn't help be aware of what, you know, happens to the body. I was actually amazed that it looked that good. What I mean, I'm talking about on a sexual level. She didn't really seem to me to be unattractive.
Were you uncomfortable, or was she uncomfortable when she was posing for you?
I certainly wasn't uncomfortable. I felt that she maybe the first few times, then she sort of, it was okay. It was a son-in-law, and, you know, she thought that anything she could do to help.
Mm-hmm.
I told her, you know, that maybe we'll sell that painting, something. So she actually thought she was posing for the good reason, a working-class woman who thought that, you know, we would make some money or something like that. And
did you?
Did I? I think when I sold those paintings, they weren't very expensive and things like that. I made something, sure. But I wish I had a lot of them today. I would have made more.
Now, you also did a naked painting of your son, Joe,
yep,
when he was 14. And right, there's a part in your book where he talks about what it was like,
yes,
to be painted by you. And he wrote that he wanted to be immortalized in your paintings, but he didn't really want to hang around and pose nude for it. He was 14 at the time.
Right.
In the painting, he's nude except for his socks. He
right
says his pubic hair was just coming in.
Right.
And then the portrait was shown at the Southampton Gallery in Long Island, New York, and half of the high school from that area had their parental permission to go to the gallery.
Right.
And he was very embarrassed.
In other words, walk into that gallery. They'd have a note from their parents that they could walk into that gallery. Go ahead.
And then finally, the police removed the painting
right
of your son, and he right was relieved. And he says to this day, he has a twinge of embarrassment when he sees it.
Yeah.
Did you realize he was going to feel that way? That, you know, at the age of 14,
no,
it was going to be kind of embarrassing.
It was all very jolly. Like, I suppose a lot of families in which, you know, you don't, there's a central pot everybody's dipping into, and that's the sort of the ones that don't speak of the dark things. I think that he may have felt that way, but maybe I even thought about it, but I didn't think it was anything too much to ask of a child, truthfully speaking. And I think he actually, you know, he did. He knew he was a painter, and that's what I do, and that he would be useful. If he was embarrassed, I'm sorry. You know, so what?
You were very close with the poet Frank O'Hara. You were lovers for a while, even
yes
though you don't think of yourself as homosexual and have, you know,
that's right,
been married.
I was
twice
so straight I could be homosexual.
But you're right that you started thinking of yourself for the first time as sexually attractive,
yeah,
when you started hanging out in homosexual circles.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Well, how did it affect me? Well, I just said it. To feel sexually attractive is rather pleasant. But I think that I didn't get that. I'm not saying that that's why I got interested in men, but that there was that difference in my existence, that women didn't talk about you know, some guy with a great ass or, you know, a great basket, as the homosexual talk at that time, and the area around the fly as it's telling you what's going on inside it. But it was sort of interesting. I mean, it brought me up to another level about sex, that I too could be, exciting to someone, is really what it amounted to. Now, I really wanted it to be with women. They would go to bed with you, but I never got the feeling that they went to bed with you because you were sexually exciting. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of silly. I feel now like a baby. I can't see how they could have not thought that. Why would they go to bed with me? They wanted to have sex with me. But I never interpreted it that way.
Artist Larry Rivers, recorded in 1992. The first major retrospective of his work is at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., through August 19th. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new film Wind Talkers. This is Fresh Air. Wind Talkers is a new World War II film starring Nicolas Cage, directed by John Woo, who also directed Cage in Face Off. Wind Talkers is set in the Pacific and is about a Marine platoon, which includes a Navajo radio operator who is a code talker, trained to transmit battlefield messages in an unbreakable code based on the Navajo language. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
When John Woo decides to tackle a genre, he doesn't have to go out and give himself a mini course in masterpieces. Growing up in one of Hong Kong's poorest, most overcrowded slums, Woo sought relief in local movie theaters, especially the ones featuring American films. Now, the 56-year-old director, who's worked in Hollywood for nearly 10 years, has made his first American combat film, and it's everything you want in a big Hollywood action picture. Nicolas Cage stars as a war-weary Marine who discovers that his new assignment is not so much to kill Japanese, though he's welcome to do that, so much as it is to murder a Navajo radio man if he looks like he's about to be captured. Working from a skeletal script by John Rice and Joe Battier, Wu has emblazoned his screen with all the familiar elements of a World War II drama. Sergeant Joe Enders is a bitter veteran of past battles by the time the movie begins, suspicious of honors and leery of friendships. A platoon's worth of soldiers are drawn from the usual ethnic and regional cross-sections, and as you might expect, dramatic tensions arise from the trouble the men have in subordinating their individuality to the group. Wu treats these familiarities as signposts for further expression, not monuments to movies past, which is the difference between classicism and entombment. It might sound strange to describe a filmmaker who made his reputation directing Hong Kong action fare, in which the bullets fly like confetti and no shot seems to last longer than a nanosecond, as a classicist. But the more you gaze into the maelstrom of Wu's films, the more you begin to recognize that they're built on the traditional structures of friendship tested under fire. Love, in other words. As Wind Talkers gets underway, Enders has finished recuperating in a Hawaii hospital following a disastrous personal experience in the Solomon Islands. The young NCO's entire command was wiped out. Here, after lying to get back into active service, he's told about his responsibilities with a new Navajo radio man.
What I'm about to tell you, Corporal, cannot leave this room. Under no circumstances can you allow your co-talker to fall into enemy hands. Your mission is to protect the code. at all costs. You understand me?
Yes, sir. I do.
Good. Congratulations. You just made sergeant.
You can't tell it from that one line, but in Nicolas Cage, Wu has found the American equivalent to his favorite Hong Kong actor, Chow Yun-fat. Wu directed Cage in Face Off, but that cinematic buzzsaw would have shredded anyone's performance. Here, Cage is a heavy-lidded, soured romantic, a Western Chow and a perfect embodiment of the Wu hero, fighting despair as he fends off the enemy. Enders and the code talker Yahtzee hook up uneasily on the eve of the invasion of the heavily fortified island of Saipan. The invasion itself is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking, both in its breadth and in its self-control. It probably doesn't take up more than an economical 3 minutes and starts with a flying camera following planes swooping over the landing beach. From there, it slowly falls to earth, capturing scenes of various engagements until it finally catches up with Enders and Yahtzee. Enders, in his terror at having to kill someone he knows, has adopted an attitude of hostility towards Yahtzee. He shuts himself down emotionally, refusing to open himself up to a partner he may have to kill. He starts dying inside. To prevent the Japanese from capturing Yahtzee, Enders turns himself into a fanatical killing machine. Since the 70s, Wu's heroes have been facing this dilemma. A larger world of social or national obligations puts them at excruciating odds with a more intimate world of personal or even familial bonds. Enders fits into this series, but not so neatly that he's just another square peg. Instead, he's another richly human variation, just as Wind Talkers itself is another enriched take on the traditional Hollywood combat movie.
Henry Sheehan is a film critic based in Los Angeles. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberto Chirac. Our engineer today is Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. And DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actress Jodie Foster about entering the business at the age of 3 and going on to make such films as Taxi Driver, The Silence of the Lambs, The Accused, and her new film, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.